This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I'd like to introduce Dr. Mario DePinto, who, as you will quickly determine from his manner of speaking, was born in Rome. And he obtained his medical and surgical training at the University of Rome, and in fact practiced for approximately 5 years prior to coming to the United States, where he ended up settling in Seattle and getting additional training in anesthesia and pain medicine at the University of Washington, where he quickly ascended to become chief of the Harborview Medical Center pain program there up until about 2013. From that point, after a lot of arm twisting, we were able to recruit him here to be our director for our pain management center and director of our chronic pain consult service here at UCSF. Dr. DePinto will be talking to us about my aching neck and my aching back, and we're looking forward to hearing about more in depth about risk factors, causes of neck and lower back pain, as well as, importantly, short and long-term management strategies. With that, welcome Dr. DePinto.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you, Mark, for the kind words of introduction. It's a distinct honor for me to be here at UCSF and to be part of this lecture series at the Mini Medical School. I've been given what I believe is an interesting topic that interests a lot of people worldwide, and I hope to guide you through these slides and discuss several topics that this presentation may bring up to the surface. I have nothing to disclose. I want you to be aware of that. And as Dr. Schumacher was alluding in his introduction, the objective of my lectures are to try to guide you through some data about the epidemiology and risk factors of neck and lower back pain. What are the most common sources and causes of neck and low back pain? And what do we have available to try to make sure that we can manage the problem for the short and the long term the best way possible? Before we start, I want to make sure that we all agree on what we are talking about when it comes down to neck and low back pain. When we talk about neck pain, we for the most part refer to pain that is localized in the neck that may or may not be radiated and refer to the upper extremities, one or both sides, and that in some cases may be associated with headaches. Headaches that for the most part are secondary to cervical spine disease in the upper portion of the cervical spine, and that because of that reason are labeled as cervicogenic headaches. When we talk about low back pain, for the most part we talk about pain that starts in the posterior aspect of the body at the lower margin of the 12th rib and moves all the way down into the gluteal area, and that can or cannot be radiated to the lower extremity, one side or both sides. So once we have cleared what we are talking about in terms of neck and back pain, let's delve into some of the epidemiology data about back pain. It is a problem that affects a lot of people worldwide. For those of you who are not familiar with the concept of prevalence is a statistical term that identifies a total number of cases of a particular problem, of a particular disease at a given in a given population at a given period in time. And problems with neck pain have a prevalence of approximately 4.9%, 5% worldwide, according to this study published in 2014 that collected data up until the year 2010. Usually peaks at a relatively young age, 45 years, and it's more frequent in female patients. On the other side, low back pain is a little bit more frequent, almost 10%, is more frequent in males, and usually peaks at a relatively old age, approximately 80 years of age. These data are different when we are going to compare them with what happens in America. When these are cumulative data about all musculoskeletal disorders that happen and that occur in America, and these data are refer in particular to the year 2012. Musculoskeletal disorder represent almost 52.1% are reported by more than 50% of patients who are 18 years and older, and the most common complaint is low back pain, almost 30% of the times, and neck pain follows knee pain, which is the second most frequent musculoskeletal complaint. Usually, females have the tendency to report musculoskeletal pain problem more frequently than males, and usually, for this data concerning the United States, the prevalence of low back and neck pain is highest for people that have are between the age of 45 and 64 years old. When it comes to the role and the problem that neck and low back pain may have in causing disability, we can see that almost 50% of the total burden of disability is associated with the development of musculoskeletal disorder is usually coming from problems with low back pain. And neck pain also causes substantial disability burden for approximately 20% of all the disability associated with musculoskeletal pain disorders. When it comes down to cost, you can immediately see that between the year 1998 and 2011, the total direct and indirect costs that are associated with the presence of musculoskeletal conditions has increased from $400 billion to almost $900 billion in America, with an increase of almost 121%. As a term of comparison, the United States GDP has increased only 32% in the same period of time, from 11.5 trillion to 15.2 trillion. I know that is probably not the most reasonable comparison to make, but just to give you an idea of how much the cost for the management of this problem has increased over the past 15, 20 years, it is staggering, it is incredible. And actually, the cost for the management of this problem represents almost 6% of the entire U.S. GDP, which is pretty interesting to me. So, what are the most critical risk factors for problems with for neck pain and for low back pain? Regardless of the age, it seems like women have, and working women in particular, seem to complain of musculoskeletal pain problem, including low back and neck pain, more frequently than working men. It has been debated why women may have more problems with low back and neck pain than men, and we have not been able to come with a very specific reason why, and it has been thrown out there the possibility that just women may have an innate more increased sensitivity to pain in general. There is age may play a role. Usually, there is a highest incidence of neck pain and back pain between the third and fourth decade, with an overall prevalence that seems to be increasing until the age of 60 and 65 years old. Occupational factors play a role, a significant role. People who do repetitive work, people who, in order to do that repetitive work, have to place themselves in awkward positions and have to maintain awkward postures. People who do a lot of vibrations work are a significant increased risk for developing problems with neck and back pain. Psychosocial factors play a significant role. High levels of emotional distress, presence of anxiety, depression, fear of movement, with the development of certain avoidance behaviors because there is this fear of movement, have been correlated with high levels of both neck and low back pain disability. Other psychosocial factors: people who are involved in jobs that are not entirely satisfactory to them, people who feel that they may have limited autonomy or a not adequate opportunity for learning and growing into the job, have significant problem with neck and back pain. And it has been also observed that people with a lower level of education represent a strong predictor of episodes of neck and back pain that may last longer and that may be associated with an overall poorer outcome than same episodes occurring in people with a higher level of education. Problems with sleep play a significant role in the generation of neck and back pain. When in this particular study, when people were asked whether or not they had problems with sleep, and the answer was sometimes, occasionally, in those patients, the risk of developing problems with chronic neck and back pain increased up to almost up to 30%. If patients reported problems with sleep happening often, almost always, chances of developing problems with neck and back pain increase up to almost 70%. Why sleep deprivation causes problems with neck and back pain, and pain in general? Because it is well known that lack of sleep induces a state of low level systemic inflammation that may end up sensitizing the system that is involved with the generation of acute and chronic pain, the nociceptive system. Also, lack of exercise and increased body weight represents a significant risk factors. Actually, the combination of lack of sleep, lack of physical activities and physical exercise, and increased body weight represents probably the worst possible combination. I would call it the perfect trifecta for problems with neck pain and back pain. Again, why? Why not exercising, or why having an increased body weight is a problem and represents a significant risk factor in the development of chronic neck and back pain? Because as for lack of sleep, it induces the development of a low-grade systemic inflammation that can increase the susceptibility to the development of chronic pain. So now that we have an idea of what the main risk factors for the conditions are, I'm going to start talking about what the most common sources of neck and low back pain are. We all know that cervical and lumbar intervertebral discs are the main source of and the main area for neck and back pain. In the picture here, we have a relatively large disc herniation that develops at the C5-6 disc level between the 5th and 6th vertebral cervical disc level. And that is a right-sided disc herniation which on the image below, right over here, you can see a compromise of the neuroforamen, which is the small hole from which the nerve root exits from the spinal canal. This patient is likely going to have neck pain that may radiate, or is going to radiate to the right upper extremity. And the pain that he is going to describe is usually shooting, stabbing, electrical shock-like, and he may have paresthesias, which are those sensations of numbness and tingling that usually we have when we have shooting, shock-like pain in the upper extremity. What is the mechanism associated with the development of pain secondary to a disc herniation? There is an underlying problem with inflammation around the nerve roots. When a disc ruptures, whatever is contained within that disc in the area called nucleus pulposus, which is an area filled with a lot of inflammatory chemical mediators, well, these inflammatory chemical mediators are released through the cracks into the outermost aspect of the disc called annulus fibrosus and leaks out of the disc around the nerve root, causing chemical irritation of the nerve root, chemical neuroradiculitis. Another source of neck pain, and in particular, are these tiny little structures that are known as cervical facet or cervical zygapophyseal joints. It's a complicated terminology just to let you know that these are structures that line the posterior aspect of the cervical vertebrae and lumbar vertebrae. They are true joints. They are as tiny as they can be, but they are true joints that are located between the C2 vertebra and the C7 vertebra that usually are located behind the plane of the intervertebral foramina. The intervertebral foramina lies somewhere around in this area over here. And in the posterior, as behind the plane of the nerve roots that exit from these foramina right over here. So a patient who has a cervical facet joint problem is likely going to have arthritic changes in that particular joints. And since these are true joints, arthritic changes can occur, and they may be associated with the development of axial back pain and maybe not upper extremity pain. The upper extremity pain can be present just because of the location of the facet joint in the near proximity of the nerve root that exits from the foramen in this particular area. We know that since these joints are true pain generators, we know in particular that the C23, the C56, and the C67 are the most frequently areas involved in the development of facetogenic pain in the cervical spine area. And this is the distribution of the particular pain patterns that may start and may radiate from these particular structures. Usually, again, as I said, the cervical facet, as I have already said, the cervical facet joint syndrome is usually characterized by the presence of axial midline neck pain that may radiate towards one on both sides. It's usually aggravated by extension of the neck, may manifest itself with usually morning neck stiffness and significantly limited neck range of motion. Other source of neck pain are the atlantoaxial joint, which is the joint between the C vertebra number 1 and C vertebra number 2. Usually, if you remember pain into the C23 area, into this particular area, pain emanating from the C12 joint usually occurs a little bit higher than the pain that starts from the C23 facet joint area and moves toward the vertex towards the top of the head rather than towards the forehead and the temple, which is one of the characteristics of the C2-3 facet joint pain. This is a picture of a patient with a C1-2 problem that it was kindly provided for me with the approval of one of the patients that had this injection that I performed when I was working at the University of Washington in Seattle. Another area of pain is the joint immediately above the C1-2 joint, that is known with the name of atlanto-occipital joint and is between C0-1. And usually the pain that comes from this particular joint area superimposes with pain that stems from the C1-2 facet joint. To put this into some kind of perspective, when we are talking about pain that starts into the mid portion of the neck and radiates up into the upper part of the neck and head, 75-80% of the time that pain, if a facet joint disease is demonstrated, may stem from the C2-3 joint. Almost 15-20% of the time that may stem from the C1-2 joint, and 0-5% of the time from the C0-1 joint, just to give you a general idea. I want also to give you a general idea of what how complex the anatomy in that particular area is. This is from a paper that was published almost 22 years ago by a guy that taught me a lot about pain medicine and interventional pain medicine, Dr. Paul Dreyfus, that at the time was working in Texas and now works in Seattle as well. And you can notice in this cartoon how close these areas are to the C1-2 nerve, to the C2 ganglion, and to the C2 ventral root. These are very delicate nerve structure that mediate painful stimuli that localize themselves into the mid portion, as I said, into the mid portion and upper portion of the neck and head. People with C2-3, C1-2, or C0-1, it is not unusual for people with this problem at the C2-3, C1-2, and C0-1 level to have, together with neck pain, problems with headaches as well. Other potential sources of neck pain include the neck muscles, include the cervical meninges, include the ligaments that support the C1-2 joint, include the vertebral artery, and include the cervical vertebral bodies. Now we can talk about potential areas, potential sources of pain in the lumbar spine area. Facet joint exists in the lumbar spine as well. They are posterior elements of the vertebrae. They are a small, tiny little structure. They are, again, true synovial joints. They have a small space. They have a synovial membrane. They have a cartilage surfaces. And they have a capsule. And they are located in front of the plane of the foramina. In this particular picture, the foramen is this white spot over here. And in this foramen is where the nerve root at that particular area is going to exit from the spinal canal. So, again, as in the cervical spine area, being true synovial joints, these joints can be affected by osteoarthritic problems like any other joints in the body. And therefore, they can generate pain. That is usually localized in the mid portion of the lumbar spine, that with potential radiation to either side, and with potential radiation to the lower extremities. What are the pain characteristics of a lumbar facet joint syndrome? It's usually more common in patients who are 65 and older. Again, as I said, is usually characterized by axial midline low back pain with or without radiation to the lower extremity. It is characterized by morning stiffness. there is a significant difficulty for patients who have this particular primate to do the first activities in the morning. It's very difficult for some of them to get out of bed and to start to do activities. It feels like they may have either the lumbar spine locked or their neck locked. And it's usually relieved by the recumbent position, and it usually has the tendency to become worse after an initial sensation of well-being, has the tendency to get worse as the day goes by. These are the lumbar facet joint pain patterns. Usually the joints in the lumbar spine that are most frequently involved with the development of facetogenic type pain are the L4-5 and the L5-S1. It's very unlikely that the pain, if radiates to the lower extremity, may extend beyond the level of the knee, which is exactly the opposite of what happened with problems occurring at the lumbar spine disc level when you have a sciatica-like pain similar to the one that you may develop in the upper extremity when you have a disc herniation at the cervical spine level. The pain in sciatica-like syndromes has the tendency to radiate beyond the level of the knee down onto the top of the foot or onto the bottom of the foot or on the side of the ankle, depending on the nerve root from which the pain seems to be stemming from. Other pain generators in the lumbar spine or in, let's call it lumbosacral spine, one of them is the sacroiliac joint, which is a joint that is localized between the sacral bones, which are right here, and the ilium, which is one of the components of our pelvic bones. It is, in surface, the largest axial joint in our body. However, only the anterior third of the joint is a true synovial joint. And it has one of the most complicated and complex innervation possible. If indeed patients are diagnosed with sacroiliac joint pain, it may be extremely difficult to manage or to treat, particularly with interventional pain management, because the nerve endings that would have to be blocked are numerous. As we know that there is a lumbar facet and cervical facet joint syndrome, so there is a sacroiliac joint syndrome. And it doesn't make any difference whether you are a man or a woman. It affects people of the same gender in equal distribution. It's more frequent in people who are between 40 and 50 years of age. Usually affects between 15 and 30% people who present with history of low back pain. And more often than not, usually causes unilateral symptoms. Of the three major structures that I have been talking about as possible sources for neck and back pain, disc, facet joints, and SI joints, we would probably say that 50% of the time, if you're having low back pain, disc is most likely the culprit. Maybe 20, 25%, 30% of the time, the facet joint is a culprit. Maybe 10, 15, 20% of the time, the SI joint is the potential culprit. What is the pattern of pain for people who have a sacroiliac joint pain problem? Usually pain is always maximal below the level of L5. L5 is the area that from the buttock area moves onto the lateral aspect of the thigh and moves on the lateral aspect of the calf and may occasionally move all the way down into the foot area. Classic L5 pain distribution moves into the dorsum of the foot. Pain may radiate from the sacroiliac joint. Pain may radiate to the hips, to the groins, to the buttocks, to the posterior thighs. However, this is a pattern that's somewhat similar to pain that may radiate and may come from the spine, from the disc, or may come from the facet. So you understand how difficult, somewhat complex, it is to try to really pinpoint what the true source of a patient's pain is. Actually, it is not unusual for patients to have a multifaceted type of problem, pain that comes from the disc, pain that comes from the facet joints, and pain that to some degree may come from the SI joint, particularly as you may have noticed in a patient like this one who has had a spinal fusion up down to the L5-S1 level. Last but not least, we have problems with back pain that may stem from muscle structures, muscle area, and the piriformis muscle is one of them. It is a tiny little muscle that you can see in this cartoon that is usually located in the buttock area, and it is one of the muscle of the lateral rotator group. It is usually located within the posterior wall of the pelvis and is partly located at the back of the hip joint, as you can see in the imagine the hip joint being on the front of this particular muscle area, and passes outside of the pelvis through the greater sciatic foramen, so basically touches and in the near proximity of the sciatic nerve, which is this yellow structure over here. What are the characteristics of a piriformis muscle syndrome? Well, to put it simply in a few words, it is a real pain in the butt. People who have piriformis muscle syndrome have pain in the buttock area. People who do a lot of sports activities or that run a lot or that have the tendency to lunge can stress the piriformis muscle. And when you stress the piriformis muscle, you end up developing muscle spasm into that particular area that can manifest itself as a muscular pain in the low lumbar spine area, and that can radiate to the buttock and along the sciatic nerve. It feels as if you are having sciatica without having sciatica. And usually prolonged sitting, climbing stairs, walking long inclines or squatting can worsen the pain. I have had problems with this just recently after spending 6 hours sitting in a flight from Boston to San Francisco with this huge wallet sitting on the back of my butt. And and I had 1 week of agony. And that's the reason why I put this wallet into the front pocket of my pants all the time. I couldn't do anything to make myself comfortable, and it can be extremely painful. Other sources of low back pain. Obviously, the paraspinal muscle, the muscle that support the bones of the lumbar spine. Lumbar spine ligaments, lumbar spine tendons, there are a lot of them like there are in the cervical spine, and vertebral bodies. So now that we have talked about potential sources of back pain, what are the most frequent causes of neck and back pain? Well, neck pain and back pain can be caused by tumors. The pictures in this area shows an area of lithic erosion of a vertebral body secondary to a metastatic disease to the bone. Can be caused by trauma. You can see a fracture dislocation on one of the thoracic vertebrae in this image. There can be compression fracture, especially for patients who have problems with osteopenia and osteoporosis, or patients who have been diagnosed with bone diseases such as, in America and in Britain, they call it Paget's disease, which is a erosive disease of the bone, but actually Mr. Paget is French, so it's Paget disease, or patients who have problems with multiple myeloma, for instance, which is a tumor of the bone marrow. Autoimmune disorders can be responsible for can be a significant cause of neck and back pain. by causing erosive disorders and erosive problems of the cervical spine and the thoracic and lumbar spine. This is the image, the lateral image X-ray of a patient with rheumatoid arthritis, but there are other autoimmune disorders like ankylosing spondylitis and polymyalgia rheumatica that can be associated with, can be causing the neck and back pain. Musculoskeletal disorders are responsible for probably the most responsible, the most frequent cause of neck and back pain. We are talking about soft tissue injury, we are talking about whiplash injury, we are talking about the most common cervical lumbosacral strain, or sprain, myofascial disorders, and fibromyalgia. And obviously joint disorders. You know, discs are joints, like the knee, the elbow, and the hip. And you can see in this cartoon what it should be, a healthy joint and healthy disc, health spine. And on the right side, you see what instead it isn't a healthy spine. What it is, a spine that is affected by osteoarthritic problem. Infections can be causing neck and back pain. Discitis is a particular infection, relatively rare, that affects the intervertebral disc, the cushion in between vertebrae. But infectious processes can affect bones, vertebral body, can affect joints, and can affect meningeal layers at the lumbar, thoracic, and cervical spine, causing inflammatory processes that cause neck, back pain, and neck and low back stiffness as well. Last, I want to tell you about another possible source and cause of neck pain, which is rather unusual. And please, I don't want you to go home thinking that any of you may have any of these problems, like, you know, a carotid artery dissection. It is a very unusual vascular disorder that can manifest itself with neck pain, among other things. And you can see in this picture how the left internal carotid artery has a much smaller caliber and lumen because it is having problems with dissection compared to the carotid artery on the right side that is a much more ample and wide lumen than that carotid artery on the left side. So we talked about epidemiology, risk factors, sources, and causes of back and neck pain. I am going to end talking about management of neck pain. The most important message that I can give you tonight is that usually neck and back pain are self-limited painful conditions. Symptoms and disability have the tendency to improve rapidly and quickly, and most patients are able to return to work or to regain whatever loss they may have, whatever function they may have lost, within a period of 4 to 6 weeks, within a period of time of 4 to 6 weeks. However, 1 in 3 patients may still complain of persistent to moderate pain 1 year after an acute episode, and 1 in 5 patients, so we are not talking about trivial numbers, 1 in 5 patients may still report substantial limitations in activity 1 year after an acute episode of neck and or back pain. How can we help with the diagnosis? It is always important to complete the most thorough possible history and physical examination. Blood work is always necessary to make sure that we are not dealing with a malignancy or we are not dealing with an infectious process. As you may have seen, malignancy and infectious process can be a possible source and cause of back pain. And obviously, we can perform X-ray of the cervical and the lumbar spine, and we usually reserve much more advanced imaging like CAT scans or MRI for patients who are starting to develop neurological issues, neurological complaints, or patients in whom pain seems to not to be improving. The main goal of management, at least the main goal of the initial management of patients with neck and back pain, is to try to use whatever means you have available to achieve pain control as quickly as possible. So NSAIDs, anti-inflammatory, are the most frequently used medications for this kind of problem, and actually seems to be not only the most frequently used, but almost the most effective mean for the management of this particular problem. Tylenol is an option. Muscle relaxants are an option. I know this sounds like a very difficult word, gabapentinoids. Some of you may have heard of medications called gabapentin or pregabalin, Lyrica or Neurontin, and these are medications that are utilized mostly for to manage seizure disorders. And because they control the ability of, we call them epileptogenic foci, to fire and cause a seizure, and so they have the ability to quiet those areas where epileptogenic foci may be present, we take advantage of the ability that they have in decreasing the activity of those foci to try to calm down nerve structure, particularly peripheral nerve structure or spinal nerve structure that may have been compressed or may have been irritated by chemical neuroinflammatory mediators like in a disc herniation problem. Usually short-acting opioids, oxycodone, Percocet, Vicodin, are recommended just for a short, brief period of time to try to make sure that the opioid activity together acts synergistically with all the other medication to try to provide the best possible pain control in the shortest period of time. Complete rest is not usually recommended, but some rest is feasible and recommended. And obviously, if you are performing activities that aggravate your neck and back strain or neck and back pain, it would be recommended for you to try to modify those activities. Injections can be an option, especially injections in patients who have problems with disc herniation and who have back and leg pain associated with that disc herniation. What is important for you to know is that injections are not going to fix the problem. Injections are going to represent a mean together with the medications to try to control pain in the shortest way possible. In this article that has been recently published in the anesthesiology literature, the authors reiterate that the injections of steroids around the nerve roots area can provide, in patients with disc herniation, some analgesic benefits up to 3 months in patients with lumbosacral radicular pain, but they do not have any impact on physical disability and incidence of surgery. However, I can say that the sooner you are able to have better pain control, the sooner you may be able to get yourself involved with other activities, such as physical therapy or other activities that can help you regain whatever functions you may have lost secondary to pain. What do injections around a specific nerve root look like? They look exactly like this. This is the L4 nerve root on the left side. Imagine the patient lying down, prone, face down. And this was provided to me by my mentor in Seattle, the guy, Dr. Ray Baker, who taught me all about interventional pain management. Interestingly, he works with the Spinal Intervention Society. Interestingly enough, and a little anecdote, this society used to call itself the International Spine Intervention Society. So the acronym was ISIS. And exactly 6 months ago, they decided that it was better for them to change their name. So from ISIS, then now they call themselves CIS. You know, it's not entirely a great name too. You know, gee, I spoke with my little sis and she told me to do this L4 nerve root injection. Anyway, epidural steroid injection may be an option also for patients with lumbar spinal stenosis. And you can see in this particular area how the degeneration of the disc at the L4-5 level and potential problem with disc herniation is causing compression of the spinal canal. And that compression of the spinal canal causes mechanical compression of the nerve roots. That compression causes swelling. And that compression causes a small, tiny microvascular injury that ends up causing ischemia around that, those nerve roots, decreased blood supply to those nerve roots, and that seems to be the mechanism by which spinal stenosis causes pain. Injecting steroid around those particular nerve roots usually helps decreasing the swelling, the edema around those nerve roots. And by decreasing the edema, the swelling, you improve blood flow to those nerve roots, decreasing whatever ischemic inflammatory problem that causes, and blocking also the ability of painful fiber, nociceptive nerve fibers, to conduct the painful stimuli. It may be very helpful and very appropriate to consider injections for this problem in patients of senior age. Why? Because spinal stenosis is frequent, more frequent in patients of senior age. Some of these patients may have underlying comorbidities that could make them not the most appropriate candidate for other forms of treatment, and particularly not appropriate for management of their pain problem with medication that may end up causing more problems than actually solving them. Problems with side effects, problems with nausea, vomiting, problems with sleepiness, drowsiness, cognitive dysfunction. So we want to avoid all of this, particularly in patients of a certain age. Intra-articular facet joints are reasonable injections to perform when we can confirm a clinical diagnosis of facet joint syndrome. Again, I want to remind you what a clinical facet joint syndrome is all about. Axial back pain that may have radiation to the lower extremities. And I remind you, pain associated with morning neck and back stiffness, pain with initial activities during the day, pain worse on neck and lumbar extension, spine extension, it can usually be relieved by the recumbent position. In this image, you see a intra-articular injection, you can see this is contrast medium into that particular joint. This is, again, one of my patients in at the pain center here in San Francisco. And this is an intra-articular facet in the L5-S1 joint level. And this is courtesy of one of the members of the defunct ISIS Society and now CIS Society. SI joint injections are helpful as well, especially when a diagnosis of SI joint syndrome has been made. Remind you, pain always maximal below L5, may radiate to different areas of the body like the hips, the groins, the buttocks, the posterior thighs. And I remind you that some of these pain patterns are similar for problems that emanate or stem from the disc, from the facet joint, and from the SI joint. Injections into the piriformis muscle can be significantly helpful in relieving the real pain in the butt we talked about and I suffered a few weeks ago. Injections that can be that into the piriformis muscle can be performed with fluoroscopic X-ray guidance, like in the picture over here, or can be performed now safely with ultrasound guidance, decreasing the need for patients to be exposed to radiation for the performance of this type of procedures. Also, What can be helpful, and I know that there might be some people here that may be a little bit skeptical, but there is some evidence to show that in order to try to provide as much pain relief as possible during the initial management of these conditions, there is some evidence that acupuncture or variations thereof, like acupressure or cupping, may be potentially helpful in the most acute and subacute phase of period in patients with low back and neck pain. Again, I have a small anecdote. I am somewhat a believer in that because I have had a personal experience with sciatica myself. I was in Italy many years ago, and I was working in a property that my family owned, and we had quite a few olive trees, and we were picking olives. And while picking olives, I ended up developing back pain and sciatica, and when I returned back to Rome, I sought the help of an acupuncturist and had a few sessions with the acupuncturist, and lo and behold, the sciatica got better. I needed to, you know, try to change activities, try to be careful the way I sat, the way I moved, the way I walked, and I had to do some physical therapy. But at least together with the other treatment modalities that we have been talking about, I did not get an injection at the time, but I used anti-inflammatories and some pain pills. I got my sciatica better in a relatively short period of time. What is the next step after we are able to achieve pain? We need to try to rehabilitate ourselves and to regain the functions that pain has allowed us to lose, unfortunately. How can we do that? The best possible way for us to do that is to get involved with physical therapy and with a physical rehabilitation program. I believe that that is the key component of any rehabilitation program. And I know that these days it's not very easy to find a very understanding physical therapist, because in my opinion, a symbiotic, a physical therapist living in symbiosis with his patient or her patient, is the key element for a successful rehabilitation program. What it is important, in my opinion, for this particular problem is for the physical therapist to understand that they do not need to recondition the patient because they need to participate to the next Olympic Games. They just need to recondition themselves to make sure that they can function. And they cannot expect that people that may be somewhat deconditioned have to perform at the level of at a level that may not be appropriate for them. They may need the care and the attention that is necessary for them to reach that particular level. And so as important as it is for a physical therapist to understand that, it is important for a patient to understand that he or she cannot expect the work to be done solely by the physical therapist. They have to be active participants in that process, and they have to religiously perform those exercises at home several times, and have to go back to the physical therapist to make sure that they are doing the exercises correctly. And once they have graduated from that set of exercises, they can go to the next set of exercises. I am a strong believer of yoga. I think that that is an extremely important aspect in the rehabilitation process of patients with neck and back pain. And there is some evidence to show that. Patients who were involved with a yoga program, we are talking about a 9-week program with weekly 90-minute sessions, did way better when compared to a self-care home exercise when in patients who had neck pain. And they felt, these patients, that they found themselves being more calm, less anxious, having a better quality of life, and having their problems with depression, fatigue, and anger improve as well. Again, And I have to thank my wife for that. I was involved in a yoga program in Seattle again. I can't do much of that here because I'm working all the time. Thank you, Dr. Schumacher. But I think it is an extremely helpful way to get in touch with your body and to try to... And you don't necessarily have to meditate. Yoga, it's not exactly what many people think might be, meditation. You learn how you can stretch, how you can move your body, how you can posture your body in a way that is going to make you, at the end of the day, feel great. Last but not least, it is important for you to continue to try to remain active as much as possible. There is enough evidence here to show, this is a very simple study. They ask a bunch of people who were having a sedentary job to try to increase the number of steps that they would take every single day. And by increasing the number of steps that they end up taking every day just by 1,000 steps over a period of a year, this group of people, men and women between the age of 20 and 45, ended up having decrease, 14% decrease in neck pain. Is that going to make a huge difference? I don't know, but it is a way to start. Again, last but not least, there are some of you that may know something about whether or not chiropractic manipulation or spinal manipulation may play a role. I say no thank you, not just because I've never had it and I hope that I will never have to have it. But this review study, systematic review of a lot of study that analyzed the use of spinal manipulation for several painful conditions, including neck and back pain, in this particular systematic review, there were four studies in the that talked about spinal manipulation for low back pain and spinal, and six studies for that talk about spinal manipulation for neck pain. Well, all these studies failed to demonstrate that spinal manipulation is an effective intervention for overall pain management. So, what can we conclude this presentation with? I can say neck and back pain syndromes are usually self-limited, but can easily convert into chronic pain conditions that can cause prolonged disability. The prevalence and the cost of this condition has significantly soared over the past 15 to 20 years. In my opinion, aggressive management of pain during the acute phase is key, because adequate pain control ends up shortening the time, the level of disability, and facilitates the rehabilitation process. We can use a different variety of treatment modalities, medications, acupuncture, injections, physical therapy, yoga, to try to manage the pain and facilitate the recovery process. And as much as we can, we should try to reduce stress associated with whatever activities we do every day. Activities that may be associated with the production of pain. We should try to exercise as much as we can. We should try to maintain our body weight as close as possible to the ideal body weight, because if we are able to reduce stress, if we are able to maintain an adequate level of exercise, if we are able to avoid activities that produce pain, and if we keep lean and flexible, we most likely will have very little, if any at all, problems with neck and back pain. With this, I want to thank you very much for your attention, and I'm open to any question that you guys may have. Please.
We've heard nothing about surgery.
The question is, we heard nothing about surgery. I deliberately did not want to talk about surgery. I'm not a surgeon, and I don't want to talk about something that I do not know much about. And I used to be a surgeon myself, so I used to, before becoming an anesthesiologist and a pain management specialist. The other thing that I have to say about that is, personally, I would try to avoid it as much as possible. And I would have to do it only if it is absolutely necessary. Only if everything has been said, done, tried, has not been helpful, or if there are problems that cannot find any solution other than with the surgical procedure, meaning neurological deficits, neurological complaints, persistent numbness and tingling that is not improving, problems with muscle weakness, and so on and so forth. The question is whether or not there is enough, there is evidence in the literature that there might be some benefits from surgery pre and post surgery. There are studies that talk about the benefits of surgery, and there are also studies that have compared conservatives' approaches to management of neck and back pain with surgery. And the majority of the studies shows that in the short-term, surgery is probably superior, but in the long-term, when the two treatment modalities are compared, there is no significant difference. Conservative approach and conservative management can achieve and can provide good results as surgery can. Actually, interestingly enough, I remember reading a surgical article in 2004. It was not, it was quite some time ago. And it was published in the Orthopedic Spine Literature. And this surgeon wanted to demonstrate with that paper that performing discectomies or performing laminectomies for the relief of sciatica pain secondary to disc herniation or sciatica pain secondary to spinal stenosis was better than having patients undergoing conservative management for 6 weeks and eventually injections. And he studied a total of 167 patients, I remember. And the information that caught my attention was that 67 of those patients, we are talking about 40% of that particular group, after 6 weeks of conservative management, and conservative management consisted of NSAIDs, muscle relaxant, physical therapy, rest, 40% of those patients needed nothing else. So they did better by themselves in 6 weeks. And so he was left with 100 patients. And he divided that patients, 50 having surgery and 50 having a series of injections. And after 3 years, he found out that basically the results were exactly the same. So if you had this, and actually the patients who were undergoing injections not in the correct way, because patients who have a radicular type of problem secondary to a disc herniation may benefit from an injection along the nerve root, while patients with spinal stenosis may benefit from an injection performed at the center of the spinal canal. And in order to be 100% sure that you are into the area where you want the needle to be, you have to perform these injections with X-ray guidance. Well, some of these patients then injections blindly without the help of X-ray guidance. And we know for a fact that when we do blindly epidural steroid injection, 40% of the times we are not even in the epidural space. So patients who had a less than optimal approach, conservative approach to their back pain problem, at 3 years, were as good as patients who had undergone laminectomies for spinal stenosis and discectomy for disc herniation. So I hope that with this I have answered to your questions about surgery. This gentleman here reported his experience having surgery many years ago and having problems with facet joint syndrome in the lumbar spine area and how working on a stationary bike is being helpful for him. Well, I think it is important for everybody in this room to know that no matter what the source of pain is, no matter what the cause of pain is, 30% of the pain that you're going to have is likely coming from your muscles. So if you're going to activate those muscles, if you're going to stretch them, if you're going to strengthen them with whatever means you have available, stationary bike for our friend here, or doing physical therapy, or doing yoga, or doing whatever you enjoy doing the most, even walking, it doesn't really matter. Do it, because if you're going to improve 30% of your pain, you have 30% less pain. And guess what? If you have a pain that you average at a 7, 30% less will make that pain what? A 5, a 4, or something like that. That could make your quality of life better, or anybody's quality of life better. It could make the... they could enjoy it. They could regain the function to some degree that they have lost. And that is important. Many people don't seem to understand that. Unfortunately, we live in a day and age where we want to have everything done right away. We want to have it done now, and we do not want to do anything for it. Unfortunately, this is not true anymore for patients with chronic pain conditions. And why that is not anymore true for patients with chronic pain conditions? Because unfortunately, we have been able to, over the course of the past 30 to 40 years, to figure out what the causes of pain are, what the mechanism of pain are, but we have not been able to come with a treatment that may have a durable response for years to come. And we need to, the ball now is in the court of the patient. In order for them to improve and get better, they need to start to discover and experience and experiment for themselves. What is it that makes them feel better? Not necessarily makes their pain better, but what makes their life better? Because if their life is better, well, their pain is going to be better too. So if you like to go to the movies, go to the movies. If you like to take a walk, go take a walk. If you like to go to the restaurants, take your wife or your husband and go to the restaurants. And forget about, oh, gee, I can move, I can walk. Well, someone will help you. Your husband will help you, your wife will help you, and you will enjoy a nice meal at a nice restaurant and don't feel and will stop feeling miserable for yourself. The answer to your question is that I don't know why it is not studied, because there may not be the interest that there should be around that particular treatment modalities. And I apologize for not mentioning that, but it's...
But it really teaches you about your body.
Thank you. Thank you, because that is... and I think that this is... this helps other people to know that there are other modalities other than the one that we have been talking already about that may be helpful.
I just don't want people to go away thinking Pilates. You have to have someone who is specialized in that.
That is exactly that.
And not on machines.
Right. I mean, our friend here is talking about how beneficial Pilates for her was. And again, you need to work with the right person. Yeah, you need to work with a person that understands what your problem is. You need to, and that enables you to understand what your problem is. And enables you to understand how you can move around your problem. And it's not that simple or that easy to find those people that have the patience and the desire to work with you. Well, muscle relaxant, there are muscle relaxants and muscle relaxant, and there are other classes of muscle relaxant that have come onto the market that are a little bit better tolerated than others these days. The problem that I have with patients who take muscle relaxant is that With any medications, more often than not, the medication is titrated up a little bit too quickly, in my opinion. The most frequent reason for a patient to stop taking medication is because they cannot tolerate the side effects, more often than not. And more often than not, the reason why they cannot tolerate the side effects is because the dose of the medication is increased up a little bit too quickly. So maybe a adjustment of the dose more gradual, more easy, to allow the patients to become tolerant to the potential side effects first, without necessarily observing any improvement in overall pain control, maybe a better way to utilize muscle relaxant in particular and any other medication in general. Muscle relaxant are supposed to do exactly as they say, to relax the muscle. However, they have central nervous system activities, and that can make you feel terrible, as you said. It can make you feel drowsy, can make you feel sleepy, can make you feel sedated. But in general, the idea behind using those medications is to try to relax the muscle enough for you to be able to use those muscles and to stretch them and to strengthen them as you should when you're having problems such as these ones that we have been talking about. So, and by using the approach that I have been describing to you, I've noticed that I have patients that are able to tolerate the medications relatively well and are able to tolerate the medications and need significantly lower amounts than the one that generally are prescribed for patients with this problem. Another problem with muscle relaxant, particularly with a muscle relaxant called Flexeril, that made our friend here feel drowsy, but you felt that it was helpful, right? To some degree, and your muscle and your doctor felt that it wasn't safe for you to continue to use it. And did he say why specifically it wasn't safe for you? Well, any medication when used for long term can eventually end up causing some problems. So the general idea behind using these medications is to try to use them for the shortest time possible. However, I think that inadequate pain control can end up being potentially worse than any... I don't want to say that side effects are better than having pain, because obviously that is not true as well. But if Flexeril wasn't indicated, or your doctor was fearing that that particular medication long-term could have caused problem to you, another medication that doesn't have the same type of side effects could have been used. Another muscle relaxant could have been used, and you could have figured out whether or not Flexeril or the other medication was going to be better. So this is a question about injections on, particularly for, if I understand correctly, chronic pain problems, chronic back pain, how often they should be performed, and after the injection, how soon can they regain physical activities, and so on and so forth. I think the most important thing that I have to say to you is this. Injections are extremely helpful for acute subacute back and neck pain conditions. To some degree, they are helpful for chronic pain conditions, but not as helpful as they can be for an acute back and pain conditions. However, they can become part of a comprehensive pain management program that is going to include all the other things that we have been talking about: physical therapy, yoga, meditation, Pilates, medication, so on and so forth. In general, to limit as much as possible the side effects of the medication injected with the injections, particularly the steroid medication, the general idea is that this procedure should be performed not more than 2-3 times in a 12-month period. So every 3-4, if possible, even 6 months. And usually we are instructing people to take it easy for 24-48 hours after the injection, but then they can do or should do whatever they want within reason. I mean, if you were not running a marathon before the injections, don't go run a marathon immediately after the injection. So use a little bit of common sense. The question is about the tendency as to whether or not this trend toward problems becoming a problem is increased over the past 10-15 years. Is just an American problem or a worldwide problem? It is a worldwide problem, but the problem is not increasing worldwide as much as it is increasing here in the United States. The perfect trifecta, as I mentioned, is a key problem here. Obesity is a rampant problem in this country. Obesity is a rampant problem at an early age in this country. I spent a few weeks in Italy last September, and they complain about obesity being a problem in young adults, but 10% of patients in childhood in Italy have a problem with obesity, compared to 45% in America. So this is a worldwide problem, but is for the most part a Western civilization U.S. type of a problem. And I forgot, the trend is not getting better. The trend is getting worse. And because of that, talking back about surgery, this is the country where we perform an average of 250,000 spine fusion surgery in a year. I come from a country where I didn't even know what a fusion surgery was 20 years ago. In Italy, fusions are basically non-existent. So I think there is a lot of money to make in fusion surgery, and that's in part of the problem. I had the most wonderful yoga instructor that I could possibly find in Washington State. The guy had a problem with drug addiction, had broken his back in a motorcycle accident, and he started to do yoga himself, and he decided to become a yoga instructor and a yoga teacher, and went through a rigorous training. To answer your question, I think that the best possible way that you can have is to try to find someone that you can trust, that you can have in one-to-one sessions with. And you can take group classes as well and see if those are appropriate for you. But I would start with a one-to-one instructor first. I had a patient, I remember, with neck pain problems. They asked me to do injections. I did injections, and I did beyond injections. And I told her, you should try my yoga instructor. She went to John, and I didn't see her ever again. I'm sorry, but we have to close it here. Thank you very much for attending this and for giving me this great opportunity. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.